USA. Get on our website, saveus.org, and I want to urge you to become a partner with us. Day after day, we're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, PO Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia 23255.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of John Quirk. And John has worked in intelligence with the Central Intelligence Agency for probably close to 30 years. He's retired now and works in asset recovery, but he takes frequent trips over to the Near East, the Middle East, and I just wanted to get his impression, having come back here within the last week or so from that part of the world. Basically, as you know, why, of course, Israel is sitting really in a very precarious position with Hezbollah to the north, with somewhere between 45 and 85,000 rather sophisticated missiles. Syria, certainly, slightly to the northeast, with a large number of missiles, probably armed with biological and chemical warheads. Then, of course, is Iran, certainly, and most of the countries over there, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, really are more concerned, apparently, about Iran and the danger of the Shias who control Iran than they are about Israel. And it appears, at least from what I've heard, that they're quite willing to work with Israel if a war should come between Israel and Iran. But let's get John's views on this, because he's been over there, he's talked to the people, he knows people there at high positions in Israel and certainly in Tel Aviv. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight, John.
Good evening. Thanks, Stan. It's nice to hear from you again, and it's nice to be back from being several months abroad.
Well, tell us what your impression is of what's going on over there. Have things quieted down? We're not hearing too much about the possibility of a war.
You know, it's a good question. It's more or less a standoff, and the United States has used tremendous power to do two things, to restart the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, and that is such a convoluted topic, it's unbelievable. Is it going to go through, isn't it, the whole issue between Israel and the Palestinians with the United States caught in the middle is about the new settlements and the settlements that are continuing and so on and so forth. And then the second part of the Iran equation is the fact that the United States is putting on new sanctions, increased sanctions, and in so doing, it is trying to persuade the Israelis not to attack Iran's nuclear research facilities. And several of the facilities, as you probably know, are up and running. Some have been blocked by computer problems, computer viruses, but the Russians basically have assisted Iran in developing a nuclear reactor. They say it's not processing weapons-grade uranium. The Russians are giving the United States a lot of guarantees. The United States is reaching out to block more and more sanctions against Iran. It's increasing and holding back more money and so on and so forth. And the Obama administration, according to Susan Rice, Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, says that we're going to force them to the diplomatic table. So that's the current status of what's going on. It's more or less a standoff between all of these parties.
Well, do we still have our military forces over there, certainly in the Indian Ocean there and in the Persian Gulf? Have we pulled some of the carrier task force out there, or do we have any idea, really know what's going on over there from the U.S. military point of view?
Well, we've pulled out most of our carrier task forces out of the Gulf, but they're standing ready in the Indian Ocean. And the reason Mr. Obama is doing that is, according to the White House and the National Security Council under him, is so we do not provoke Iran. We do not give Iran an excuse to do something.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is John Quirk. John, are you on a hardline telephone?
I'm on a cell phone.
Do you have a hardline telephone, a handy we could call you on?
I do not.
All right, then we'll put up with the cell phone. We want to hear what you have to say. But anyway, Chris, basically then, things are sort of in a standoff position. Now, do you think things will change after the election? Certainly, I have a feeling that the Obama administration doesn't want anything to rock the boat between now and November 2nd. But what about after that? Do you think things will go on, or do you think that things could heat up after the elections?
Well, I certainly think so, because if you look at some of the statements by Admiral Mullen and other people in the administration, not including Mr. Gates, but some of our military people, they say they are ready to not only assist Israel, but possibly the United States, in fact, would take action. The whole issue revolves around timing, and we've had constant different estimates of when the Iranians would actually have a warhead if they don't have one already. They do have a deployment system. The United States is trying to persuade Israel that the Iranians, and this starts in August, really, of 2010, the clock, that they will not have a warhead ready for at least 1 year, about September, probably, of 2011. The Israelis disagree with that analysis, and they're pressuring Mr. Obama to go ahead and take action. But at the same time, they need U.S. support. So they're giving the Mitchell and the Mrs. Clinton plan for Mideast peace a chance. But I think we'll see some hostility probably after the election.
Well, now, one of my major concerns from an Israeli point of view would be, certainly if there is an attack on Iran, whether it would be American or Israeli, why, of course, this would release Hezbollah. They would release a wave after wave of missiles on Israel. And I don't see how a small country like Israel could possibly withstand, a massive missile attack from Hezbollah and possibly from Syria.
Well, that's right. And a lot of people are now shifting their position again, and they're saying that the United States is the one that should attack Iran. We've had another distraction which has happened over the last week or so. And if you've been reading about the terror warnings in Europe, where France is warning its citizens not to go to England, and the United States has been warning the citizens.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Sydney John says that he thinks that maybe after the elections there should be some military action over there. Nobody's really ready to do much of anything before the elections, but of course Admiral Mullins and some of our military people have said that they are prepared, if necessary, for an attack on Iran. Now, the other thing is that there have been other issues coming up quite recently. One of them, of course, we haven't touched on, and I'll ask John about that, but this is certainly the virus or the attack on the computers over there, computer viruses that have attacked Iran's nuclear power plant and their other computer systems. Basically, this is a computer virus attack specifically on Iran. But John was just saying that here this last 10 days or so, we've been hearing a lot about the fact that our government has definite proof that possibly there might be an attack. And, of course, they're saying they don't know who's going to do it or where it's going to come from, but there may be a terrorist attack and we should be on alert. John was saying that the French are telling their citizens not to visit Great Britain because of this threat of an imminent terrorist attack. So you pick up the story there, please.
Well, something dramatic happened in the last few days, and particularly today. Graham Allison, who runs the Nuclear Terrorism Threat Analysis Center, I think it's called the Balfour Center at the Kennedy School for Government in Harvard, on radio today, said it is likely, more than likely, that Al-Qaeda has nuclear bombs in New York, Washington, Boston, and possibly, he alluded to, Miami. Well, this just freaked everybody out, and I called a number of people in our Weapons of Mass Destruction Center, and they said that he's probably greatly exaggerating. He shouldn't have said something like that. There's more rumors that the government is keeping a closer eye on possible terrorist threats, basically from Pakistanis and possibly from airplanes. So this has been credible intelligence going on. The target is Al-Qaeda. They feel that Al-Qaeda is ready to attack either in Europe, which is a high probability, or possibly in the United States. So it's there's lots of rumors going around. There's lots of rumors of imminent threat. It's kind of inserted itself in the whole paranoia about what Israel is going to do with Iran and vice versa. So I think that there's certainly a lot of intelligence that we're getting about an old topic, and that is, does Al-Qaeda have the ability to obtain nuclear weapons? Do they have nuclear weapons? Have they obtained nuclear materials at all from Pakistan, from possibly, you know, the origins of the Khan nuclear development? Dr. Khan is one that, you know, has helped North Korea, he helped Libya, and he helped certainly Pakistan develop nuclear weapons. Pakistan is starting to fall apart, as well as Afghanistan. We're having great problems there, so this is another, I would say, nuclear threat area, and it's rather a distraction from what's happening with Iran. And what bothers me about it is that the Israelis, who have acquiesced and waiting for Mr. Obama, are getting probably more and more impatient. They're running out of time. They really want to do something against Tehran, mainly a military strike, and they're losing patience with the United States. So we've got two issues here. We've got these rumors that have started about 10 days ago about Al-Qaeda, and then we have the current situation that just continues to go on and almost fester between the United States and Israel about Iran's nuclear development.
Well, now, what about this computer virus? This sounds like, at least from what we have yet to hear, is that, you know, this is a very, very bad virus. It's really had to play havoc with Iran's computer system. Obviously, this is a, for all intents and purposes, an act of war. This is not going all over the world. It's targeted at Iran. There's only two places it could come from, either Israel or from the United States. We don't know where. But apparently, the Iranians are very, very upset about this.
Well, the whole issue of cyber warfare is coming to the forefront, because in all of our dealings in cyber warfare out of the Pentagon, our cyber warfare capabilities are aggressive ones. Although we talk about China attacking us in cyber warfare, the Pentagon has a number of units which engage actively in cyber warfare. In other words, going into computers using these spider networks and breaking down other people's computers. And certainly we have probably, if you look at the whole world of cyber warfare, the United States leads in the technology with all of our signals intelligence, with our National Reconnaissance Office, with the military. It mainly comes out of the Pentagon. And then probably number two is China. China is working on cyber warfare, where they'd be able to shut down all of our computers, our electric power plants, our water power plants, and so on and so forth. But the real aggressive country is the United States. I'm not saying the United States did this, but and Israel has capability. But it would be a typical covert action that does not have to be approved by the Senate or the Congress. It's unlikely, because of the Boland Amendment and the restrictions placed on CIA and the National Security Agency, National Security Council, excuse me, that they would not be able to engage in this. But there are no such restrictions on cyber warfare on the part of the Pentagon. And in fact, if you read the law governing cyber warfare by a Marine colonel named Gary Sharp, who's written quite a bit on cyber warfare, we are actively engaging in cyber warfare. We are committed to do so. And besides that, when you're talking cyber warfare, a lot of members of Congress really don't really know what that means. I'll tell you what it means. It means exactly what you said. It's using our computer systems combined with our signals intelligence capabilities, National Security Agency in Fort Meade, to go in to another computer network. It could be the computers that run the nuclear research facilities at certain places in Iran, and shutting down and destroying their computers. And that's what seems to have happened. And probably the country that has the greatest capability to do that is the United States. We have facilities right around, and I was in some of these places. We have facilities in Azerbaijan, which borders Iran. We probably have facilities, I don't know for sure, in Afghanistan. Israel, it would be a little far for them to engage in this, even though computers and the Internet are, you know, there's no borders, more or less. The United States has the capabilities with ships at sea, listening stations, cell phone towers, computer bases in Turkey. We have computer bases in Turkey, Azerbaijan. We have bases in some of our facilities, Diego Garcia, and along the Gulf, right across from Iran, that we would probably be the major suspect in doing such a thing. And I don't think it's such a bad idea. It's something that would be very difficult for the Iranians to trace, and it would be almost a harmless type of thing where nobody's getting hurt, but it would restrict their ability to do everything from process or enrich uranium.
But, of course, if they were to do something like that to us, we would consider it an act of war, and we'd probably take military action against a country that would do something like that, wouldn't we?
Yes. The whole legal structure of cyber warfare is very amazing. It's governed by certain United Nations rules. It's governed by certain treaties. But if you look at it, it's extremely nebulous when it comes to the initiation of such attacks. In fact, it's almost in cyber warfare, it's advocated that you attack. In other words, there are some laws that say if a foreign power is developing any hostilities, it doesn't even mention nuclear, it is perfectly acceptable for the United States or another country, this is all cyber law, if you will, to engage in cyber warfare. It's very difficult to prove who did it, because viruses, that's one genetic term, but the other term is the use of spider networks to go into internets, to go into websites, to go into computers. It's not just attacking computers through a virus. It's a variety of very specialized high-tech capabilities. And the leading component and expert in this for the United States is the military. It's out of the Pentagon. It's Army, it's Navy, and I think to a certain extent Air Force. But there are cyber units. They have their own special units composed of very brilliant guys in the Pentagon that know how to manage and operate computers. And it is an act of war. It's not anything there's anything in between. It is an act of war. But gathering the evidence is very difficult.
I don't think the average person wants America to go to war with Iran or expand their wars over there. And yet we, for all intents and purposes, are at war with Iran. Certainly the Congress had appropriated some $400 million to give the intelligence agencies to finance terrorist organizations to overthrow the regime. That was three or four years ago. That's an act of war. We put sanctions on Iran. That's an act of war. Just like we put sanctions on Japan before the attack on Pearl Harbor. We were at war with Japan before that, but the average American had no idea back in 1941 we were at war with Iran, with Japan, and any more than that, they think they understand we're at war with Iran today, because it isn't really what the people want. There seems to be an agenda there, and, well, I think we're getting deeper and deeper involved. We'll be right back. Okay, go right ahead, John. Certainly that.
Well, it's interesting. In May of 2010, the Pentagon set up a new command. In addition, you know, we have Southcom, we have.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work, it's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey Water Filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
Military, he said, before it was apparent he was violently anti-military, and yet, of course, he authorized the additional troops there in Afghanistan, continuing the war in Afghanistan, and John thinks that perhaps he is listening more to his military advisors, although I'm a little surprised that General James Jones is leaving. He's the head of the National Security Council. I'm not sure it'll change policies at all. Thomas Donilon, who's replacing him, comes as cut from the same bolt of cloth, but General James Jones is going to be leaving his very, very powerful post to take a position in directing the Democrat Party. But you go right ahead.
Well, you know, getting back to this whole cyber thing, not to beat a dead horse, but when you're talking about Hezbollah in Israel, one of the pretexts for war that Israel used against Hezbollah is that they said that they had tremendous intelligence in 2006 that Russian hackers, scientists and cyber warfare experts were attacking Israeli computers. And people don't know about this, but Israel then got into all of this and they expanded their attacks against Hezbollah. They invaded them, and they found later, in Richard Clark's book is a good read, he found later that Russian high-tech companies were actually helping Hezbollah. So here's the danger with this whole cyber warfare thing that you mentioned. It could be a pretext for war, just like in World War I, where you had the Archduke Francis Ferdinand assassinated. People were looking for an excuse almost to go to war. This is the same thing. This could bring about Iranian activities. It could be pushing the button to get Iran to start hostilities. And if the United States engaged in cyber warfare, it has to come with authorization of the President of the United States. I mean, this could make a good book someday. Or if the Israelis did it, because they have better capabilities since 2006, and the United States has helped them model their cyber capabilities, the catalyst for a conflict could be that Iran could feel that we're engaging in cyber warfare not only to destroy their nuclear research facilities and hold them back, but to possibly neutralize everything in Iran. Not that everything in Iran is run by computers by any means, but the United States is actually more, in some ways, more vulnerable because everything in this country is run by computer, our electronic grids and everything. But it could be, getting back to this point, it could be a pretext that the Iranians would be wise to do one of two things. Either enter into negotiations, which Susan Rice has alluded to over the last 2 weeks because of sanctions. The cyber warfare activity would be the covert action part of United States policy. And or they could actually strike out at either the United States targets or Israel. But I think one way or another, there's going to be a conflict. There doesn't seem to be any movement on Iranians to negotiate diplomatically. They don't seem to be intimidated by the United States sanctions. They don't seem to be intimidated by Israel. So that could also be, you know, one of the flashpoints for military action.
Well, of course, we've heard that certainly Saudi Arabia and Egypt are both very much concerned about Iran, as I mentioned earlier, and they're encouraging America to do something, and they're looking to America because they're incapable of doing anything about Iran. Do you think that certainly to maintain our relationships with Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, why we might be certainly much more prone to take military action over there so that we would maintain the respect and backing?
Yeah, you know, one of the problems that in each of those countries, we have, fairly good relations, although remember 17 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of people being tired of some of the extortion that the Saudis continue to pay to people in Al-Qaeda. and the expansion of Wahhabi mosques. Where I live in Boca Raton, they just built a huge new mosque and educational center. It's the second one within a mile of another mosque, and it's all funded by the Saudis, okay? And the Saudis, with their Wahhabi extreme fundamentalism, you know, it's a threat to the United States, in my view. It's not, you know, Islam in itself could be construed, you know, as a threat by some, but I think the Saudi version is definitely a threat.
Hold that thought, I agree. Dr. Stan, I guess John Quirk, and Sean is just saying he feels that the Wahhabi influence here, the Saudi Arabian influence in the United States, is really quite a menace to America, that the real militant form of Islam is being actively preached by Saudi imams, financed by Saudi Arabia, coming to America. And we would almost have to ask, why would our government allow Saudi Arabia to send people, the clerics, to the United States to preach a violent anti-American philosophy? That's really, in some ways, just doesn't make any sense, John, and yet I know it's taking place.
Well, the what's happening, you know, it's not politically correct to condemn Islam per se, although most Americans even today are suspicious about it. I just finished writing a book about Islam and the terms of Islam, and most Americans really are not familiar with Islam and a lot of the terms or the difference between Sunnis and Shias. The problem with Wahhabism is that it influences everything from funding mosques, schools, and social programs. The expansion of mosques, schools, education, Muslim school buses, social programs are expanding in the United States, and the people that have the money to fund them are Saudis. And the Wahhabi sect, which is a Sunni Islamic sect, funds them. And at the same time, we have this Dr. Jekyll and Hyde approach to Saudi Arabia. We get oil from them. We're friends. Our CIA and Special Forces is in Saudi Arabia.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, John is really, of course, talking about Saudi Arabia. And certainly Saudi Arabia is sending over their imams here to the United States to preach this violent form of anti-American radical jihadist movement. The Saudis are financing, they're building mosques all across America. They're establishing and financing schools where hatred of America is being promoted, subversive activities, financed by our good friends, the Saudi Arabians, which really doesn't make much sense. And then John was just saying about our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Why don't you go ahead and pick that up?
Well, that's one of the problems that we have. It's a weird relationship. We protect Saudi Arabia with our missiles, with our new defense system there. We take their oil, we pay the oil, we kind of protect the whole family. There's no movement towards democracy in that country at all, and yet we permit the Saudi Saudis to bring money in here and fund the development, the new development of mosques. Now, a lot of the other Muslims, including Iranians, who are not Muslims but who are Muslims but not Arabs, and all the other Arabs, whether they're Pakistani, Iraqi, from Yemen, Chad, Saudi Arabia, I mean, not Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Malaysia, all the other countries, they need money to build mosques. They don't have a lot of money. So the Saudis are willing to do that, but they also throw on their Sunni Islamic Wahhabism more or less as a condition to get money, to give money to the development of mosques. It's happened in Boca Raton. It's happening all over Washington, D.C. It's happening in the suburbs of Chicago with the expansions of mosques. So it's a weird situation that the United States has with Saudi Arabia. And, yes, the Saudis are Sunnis, and they're against the Shia in Iran. And, of course, the Shia sect in Iraq is a threat to the Saudis. So it's a big problem, I mean, because I think to a certain extent, and this is my opinion, it may not be shared by others, Wahhabism is a fifth column that's being placed in the United States. I don't say, you know, other Muslims are bad or planning or jihadists, but Wahhabism, I think, is a mask and a stealth operation for radical jihadist Islam, Islamic movements against the United States. Now, Egypt, which also would like to see Iran taken off the chessboard, has a different kind of influence, and it's coming to America. And it's expanding, and that's the whole concept of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, which started in Egypt, which inspired bin Laden, which is the mother or the father of Al-Qaeda, is expanding in the United States. It went over from Egypt into Germany. There's all kinds of sects, religious, educational schools. They were unbelievably radical. They advocated violence. They're listed as a terrorist organization. They are now coming into the United States, disavowing terrorism, and being and setting up organizations that are overt. Now, I believe it's a stealth move to eventually put more people here, get established, get Americans used to them, be open and overt, but not advocate terrorism, but at the same time be another fifth column, which is located here. And I'll tell you what's really bad when you look at our law enforcement in this country. They have tremendous guidelines. They're not allowed to wiretap mosques, the phones in mosques. They're not allowed to be too aggressive in a religious sense against mosques, okay? And what's happened is a lot of the Muslim groups, because they're either legitimately afraid of law enforcement, or they have a paranoia about law enforcement, which is greatly exaggerated, they're establishing political action groups, and they're hiring lawyers to sue federal officers, to hire private investigators to find out who's investigating them, and then make complaints about it. So the existence of what we have in this country, both from Wahhabism, some jihadists, any kind of cells that Hezbollah, Hamas, or Al-Qaeda has in this country, is really a growing fifth column against our way of life. And while many in our government recognize this, there's not a lot we can do because we've become so democratic in our country, common sense has turned on its head.
Well, Chris, but I agree with everything you're saying, but one of the most incredible things is the fact that in our prison system, why they're allowing these radical imams coming over from Saudi Arabia preaching this radical form of jihad in our federal and state prisons. And, of course, if you convert, at least with a federal prison, if you convert to the Muslim faith, and many, many of the black people do because, of course, they have protection, if you don't belong to some group in prison, why, of course, your life could be very very, very short. We have terrible violence in our prisons and molestation and all sorts of sexual molestation of people. But if you convert to the Muslim faith, you get special meals. You get time off to pray five times. You get a day. You get a chance to celebrate all the Muslim holidays. You have the protection of the group. And I don't understand why, you don't get special privileges or special food if you're a Christian, but if you convert to this radical form of Islam, you get all these special privileges. It's almost as if the prison system was fostering this radical form of Islam.
Yes, and there are Islamic groups that are against this that would agree with us. The Islamic Supreme Council of America, there's groups in China that are against Wahhabism. They've warned the United States. We have advisors in the Muslim community that tell us about both the Muslim Brotherhood as a radical group and Wahhabism coming in to fund mosques. The problem is, the best example of this is the whole issue of building a Muslim educational center near the 9/11 site. And here's the problem as I see it. The leftists and the liberals and the civil rights people come out and they lecture us about freedom of religion and the right of any religion to do anything to operate freely. Well, we're Americans. Nobody has to lecture us about freedom of religion. We know what freedom of religion is like. The whole idea of building an Islamic educational center near 9/11 is not an issue of religion, it's an issue of sensitivity. I ask the question, why don't the Muslims that are building the center have more sensitivity about all the Americans that have died there and the families that have suffered? See, the liberals and the leftists come out and say it's a matter of freedom of religion, and we don't want to persecute people. And it goes back to every kind of religious group that's ever come to America, whether it's Mormons, Amish, Mennonites, Catholics, any kind of religion, Jews. Our Constitution does not put up with people persecuting. Now, a lot of these groups have been persecuted, but America, great country it is, has the mechanism, the legal mechanism to protect that. The difference with Islam, the radical part of Islam, not the soft part of Islam, the difference in Islam is that the people that are coming in, by any stretch of an imagination, when you're talking Muslim Brotherhood or Wahhabism, they're seditionists and they're terrorists. And yet, they hide behind religion. So our law enforcement community, our government, our legislature, our executive branch, it's not that they don't want to do anything. They're handcuffed from doing anything. And these people that are really evil, Wahhabism and radical Islam, they're really evil people. They're flaunting and using the Constitution more or less in a stealth way to establish themselves here. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they talk hatred against the United States and so on and so forth, which they'll claim freedom of speech, but they mask it under freedom of religion. And I don't think there's any way the United States is going to be able to stop that unless there's an all-out war. And we did what we did in World War II. We started rounding up the Nazis and the German-American Bund, and unfortunately we persecuted the Japanese in a wrongful way. So I just think that Wahhabism is going to continue to spread here because they're financing mosques. And I think that the Muslim Brotherhood and other terrorist groups are going to use religion to hide behind it. And it puts tremendous restrictions on our counterintelligence groups, the FBI, the military, the CIA, and even our electronic eavesdropping groups. It puts tremendous restrictions on them. So it's a very serious problem, and I see not only, we're talking constantly about conflict between Iran and Israel, I think we're going to have our own problems in this country with this type of behavior.
I certainly agree with you. In fact, I'm very, very concerned about the fact that if under the guise of dealing with this terrible threat, they would begin rounding up people like you and I who may have questions about some of the policies of the Obama administration or the Bush administration or the next administration here. But once you begin, of course, to restrict people for what they're saying, or at what point do you stop? But the question is, why in heaven's name are we backing the Saudi Arabians? We've got plenty of oil here, but we've been blocked at every turn. We can be energy independent. I mean, certainly we are terribly offended, you know, by the oppression of women. Who oppresses women more than Saudi Arabia? And yet we have kept that feudal system that which oppresses women and chops off hands and feet and heads. We've kept them in power for the last 50 years, and we have to ask ourselves from a logical and moral point of view, why we block Saudi Arabia, why then we block development of nuclear power here, why we're tearing out our dams so that we won't have the ability to have hydroelectric electricity, why we won't allow the massive development of the massive oil fields we have here, why we maintain our reliance on Saudi Arabia. A lot of things just don't make sense.
Well, here's the other thing. If you talk to people in the Muslim world that want to be friends with the United States, that are friends, you know, people, the media and people bring out the fact that Israel is the cause of a lot of problems in the Arab world. Well, I'm going to tell you, a lot of Arab countries, and I've lived there and I've traveled, resent Saudi Arabia even more, not just because of Wahhabism, but because of the way they behave. And if you sit down and you talk to Libyans or Egyptians or Moroccans, if you talk to Yemenis, if you ask them, what's the number one country that you loathe the most, let's say besides Israel, it would be Saudi Arabia. Now, to answer your question, there's an incestuous relationship that goes back to the founding of Saudi Arabia when the United States, back in the 40s, under Roosevelt, made deals with the Kingdom of Saud, the Saud family, and we pushed the British to the side. We immediately went in with military. We trained their National Guard. We supply special forces and special executive protection to the Saudi prince. And the answer is, it's not just strategic. It's all about oil. It's about oil. Americans are in love with oil. Our government has been gluttonous for oil since the end of the war. And Saudi Arabia bends over backwards at extremely high prices to supply us with oil. They've also backed up the United States in many OPEC decisions. They've abandoned us a couple times, and there is no movement at all in that country towards any kind of democracy, respect for women. It's a paranoid country that is constantly fighting off intrigue and palace revolts, and when the young Saudis go abroad and they see what democracy is like, they come back with these ideas, they're immediately put down or bribed or so on. The Saudis also, one of the worst things that they do is they pay extortion to terrorists. They condemn terrorists within their own borders, but at the same time, for many years, they funded bin Laden. They gave him money. They set up relations with the CIA and bin Laden in Afghanistan. I mean, the CIA later, you know, changed that and abandoned it, but the Saudis still pay a tribute because they're so afraid of being overthrown. So, and at the same time, while we need oil and why it is a national security issue, the biggest fear I have is the export of Wahhabism around the world, okay, and especially to the United States. And it gets involved in the whole Sunni Shia conflict. You know, I mean, some people say that eventually we're going to completely abandon any relations with Shia, i.e. Iran, Shia in small Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, the larger Shia minority in Iraq, and we're going to be back in bed with the Sunnis, both in Iraq, remember Saddam Hussein was Sunni, and the Saudis and other people. So the United States keeps shifting not allegiances, but alliances. And I think the only thing that would change that is if there's a real major catastrophic event in the United States that we could point our fingers to the Saudis or another group. Right after 9/11, when we found out 17 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, the total Pentagon and law enforcement facilities of the United States, maybe not the CIA so much, but certainly people in the FBI, the Pentagon, and the other intelligence services wanted to turn their back on Saudi Arabia. It went that way for a couple years, okay, right after 9/11, and then, bam, the Bush people were back in bed with the Saudis again. And even under Obama, even with all the smears against Obama that he's a Muslim or pro-Muslim, he's as much pro-Saudi as the Bush people were, as almost every administration has been since Franklin Roosevelt. So it's a conundrum. It's very difficult to understand.
It certainly is, and we're in very, very difficult times now. Certainly we have this growing animosity, I believe, between the Muslim world and the United States. Certainly what we're doing over in Pakistan, and we just accidentally kill a few people here and a few people there. The Pakistanis certainly are actually attacking our convoys going through Pakistan, bringing supplies into Afghanistan. It's a very, very unsettled part of the world. And remember, of course, Pakistan does have nuclear weapons. And then, of course, we send our drones over there, and they will kill people, and sometimes they kill terrorists, and sometimes they kill Afghans. And how would we feel if somebody was flying drones over New York and selectively killing people? Well, John, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I would say that the current status where, most people blame most Americans, a lot of Americans blame Israel.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Quirk and Sunday John is pointing out that so many of our problems are related to energy dependence. Certainly, Iran, major income comes from oil, and of course it's funding Hamas, it's funding Hezbollah. Saudi Arabia is funding the Taliban, funding Al-Qaeda. They're right along with Pakistani intelligence. And of course we say, oh, well, we've got to support Saudi Arabia because we're dependent on oil. Basically, it's all a lie. If you've never seen my newsletters, they're up on the internet at radioliberty.com. On the oil deception, we've got the greatest deposits of oil anywhere in the world, certainly certainly in the Abakov reserves, and there in Colorado we've got certainly massive reserves in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve. Oh, we can't drill there because of the reindeer and because of the wildflowers about 2 weeks a year, and we can't drill off the North Slope of Alaska. You need to get certainly the four tape set we have, a four tape set on the oil deception. And of course, if you don't have access to the internet, you can just request those two newsletters on the oil deception. And then, of course, you need to get the book, The Energy Non-Crisis, by Lindsay Williamson. With that information, you will know more about oil than most people do. And then, of course, you have to understand that we are actively allowing Islamic terrorists training camps here in the United States. Our guest at our conference a week from Sunday will be Dr. Paul Williams, who's the expert on the Islamic training camps here in the United States, radical Islamic training camps, where they're training ex-felons with rifles, and even some of them are going over to Afghanistan, where they're actually killing American soldiers and then allowed to come back here. And you say this just doesn't make sense, and you're absolutely right. Very little of what's going on in the world makes sense today, especially when you realize, of course, that we were the ones who brought the radical clerics to power in Iran back in 1979. The CIA toppled the Shah and brought those clerics to power. And in 1979, I can remember thinking, why would we topple a friend of the United States, a Shah, and bring to power a potential enemy? Well, in 1979, it didn't make much sense. But if you understand that everything's a long-term plan in this spiritual battle that's being waged, it makes a lot of sense because they want a war and it's coming. I don't know when it's coming, but it could come at any time. Certainly our economy is failing. Our dollar is falling. There are latest reports out of the real possibility of food shortages throughout the world in the next year or two as crops throughout the world are failing and the beehives are being destroyed by certainly pesticides. They know what they're doing. They're intentionally destroying the beehives throughout the world. These things are not happening by accident, but if you go back and you read Revelation 6:8, it talks about how, you know, they're going to destroy a quarter of the population of the world by pestilence and war and famine, and I believe these things are coming. There are all sorts of new diseases out there. We never saw them before, but we're seeing them now. They all, and so many of them, seem to have begun either with a government vaccine programs, like the one that they gave the hepatitis B vaccine to homosexuals in San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles. That's just where the AIDS epidemic came. And they gave that same epidemic in Africa, and lo and behold, that's where the AIDS epidemic began in Africa, with an experimental hepatitis B vaccine. Covered the whole story in a book called Emerging Viruses by Len Horowitz. And, of course, could this be intentional? Well, we're not trying to stop the epidemic. We've never been allowed to use standard and effective public health approach to the epidemic. If you haven't read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, you need to get it. AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, and then don't forget my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Remember, we're having an all-day conference on October 17th, a week from Sunday. You're going to have your reservations in by Monday because we have serving lunch and we have to know how many people. So if you're interested in coming or bringing a friend, call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Let us all be grateful.
This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine and now a regular guest here at Radio Liberty. He has his own radio program, has his own blog. And William, it's so good to have you with us again.
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, what are we going to talk about tonight?
I don't know if you've spoken about this on your program today, but there is an unfolding story in New Hampshire right now that is both infuriating and very instructive. And this, of course, refers to the abduction of Cheyenne Irish, a newborn who was seized from a hospital literally hours after being born a couple of days ago, the Concord Hospital in New Hampshire. I don't know if you covered this yet, Dr. Stan.
No, I haven't even heard about it. I'm looking forward to it. Tell us what happened.
It really is an ugly case. She's the child, apparently the first child of a couple, Jonathan Irish and Stephanie Taylor. They're unmarried. Jonathan Irish, whom I spoke to today, refers to Stephanie as his fiance. She has two other children who are the subject of a Child Protection Services investigation for neglect. This has been going on for about 21 months. I don't know the circumstances. I'm still waiting to get some paperwork that would give me some of the details. Mr. Irish himself has been under investigation for a number of so-called firearms violations. He's not charged with a crime. He's been accused of carrying a concealed weapon without a permit, but he's not in custody. He's not behind bars. He's not subject to arrest or probation or parole. But a couple of days ago, their child was born and then seized by so-called Child Protection Services officials, backed, of course, by state police there at the Concord, New Hampshire Hospital. The really infuriating part of this story, and this is where I think we have a tremendously troubling precedent, potential precedent for future outrages of this kind, is the fact that the affidavit, the materials that were used to seek a change of venue with respect to the parental custody, or the custody, rather, of this child, this newborn girl, the seventh point on that document lists Mr. Irish and his affiliation with the Oath Keepers, which is inaccurately described as a militia, as a cause for concern and as an illustration of his supposed unsuitability to be a parent. The Oath Keepers are an organization of active duty and retired law enforcement and military personnel. They were assembled by a brilliant man by the name of Stuart Rhodes, who is himself retired military, I believe a West Point graduate, and a practicing attorney who lives, if I remember correctly, in the Las Vegas area. Mr. Rhodes organized this group for the purpose of teaching constitutional principles and, most importantly, the fundamental American concept of interposition to people in law enforcement and the military. Interposition simply means that you get between the innocent and those who would do them harm. The most basic form of interposition, I think, is the role of the father in a home. The duty of a father is to get between trouble and his family, to find out which direction trouble is coming from and interdict it before it reaches his family. The only purpose that government legitimately serves is to interpose against the aggression of the lawless to protect the innocent. That's sort of the purpose of Oath Keepers. But by virtue of the fact that Mr. Irish had some distant association with this group, he's now seen as an unsuitable parent, and therein lies the troubling precedent.
Well, now, how would they even know that he was a member of Oath Keepers? Yeah. Is the government keeping track of
that's
who signs this?
The point. That's the point. And that's, of course, a matter of further investigation, but I suspect that we're going to find that they're, in a very detailed way, keeping tabs of such affiliations.
Well, we know that they're keeping dossiers on of people all across America. Certainly, the Lieutenant General William Odom, who wrote in his book, you know, Fixing Intelligence, asked the question, should the government be, military be keeping dossiers on American citizens? Well, you go right ahead, William.
We were talking about Mr. Irish, this fellow from Concord, the Concord area in New Hampshire, who is described as being a member of Oath Keepers, which was misrepresented as a militia. And the question, of course, is, to what extent would government be keeping tabs of people who are affiliated with this group? The point is, he's not affiliated with the Oath Keepers. I don't know whether he's active duty or retired military or law enforcement, but apparently he and his wife, or his future wife, his fiancée, had been involved in an online discussion forum which was associated with the Oath Keepers. Now, on the basis of this tenuous connection, he was described as a member of this supposed militia called the Oath Keepers.
Did you ask him when you talked to him whether he was a member?
I was only able to talk with him for about 15 minutes because at the time I called him this afternoon, it was about 3 o'clock, 3:45 actually, my time here, he was being chased off of the property of the Concord Hospital, being chased out of the parking lot. He'd received a document, like apparently it was hand-delivered by a representative of the local police department saying that if he didn't depart and if he ever returned, unless it was some kind of a medical emergency involving himself personally, he'd be subject to criminal trespass charges. Now, his fiancée, the mother of his daughter, is still recovering from giving birth, and I don't know where his daughter is located. Presumably, she's still there in an incubator or nursery facility there in the hospital, but that is something I wasn't able to find out. And one of the other things I meant to ask him, I was only able to ask him in bare outline about some of the things that had happened. I wasn't able to ask him about his level of involvement with the Oath Keepers, but from what I understand, having spoken today on a couple of occasions with Stuart Rhodes, who's the founder of the Oath Keepers, this guy's not a member of the group. He's just somebody who was involved in some kind of peripheral discussion on an online forum that was connected to the Oath Keepers group. But even if he had been a member of the Oath Keepers, this is something I find really interesting. If he'd been a member of the Oath Keepers, he would have been somebody who, in his professional life, would be seen as perfectly suitable to be carrying a weapon and to use it for the purpose of enforcing government policy. That would be somebody somebody who would be considered trustworthy by other members of the law enforcement fraternity rather than being treated as a criminal suspect. But the interesting thing that I find about this case, and I just barely, within the last hour and a half, posted a detailed essay on this subject at my blog, Pro Libertate. If this guy is a criminal suspect, if he's plausibly suspected of crimes of such gravity that supposedly there's justification for seizing his child at gunpoint just hours after she was born, why is he free? Why isn't this guy behind bars? Why isn't he subject to some kind of detention? I mean, they're treating him as if he were some kind of a public menace to the extent of actually...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply pointing out that the gentleman in this case certainly has not been arrested. Supposedly, he had carried a gun, whether he has a permit, or whether he's eligible for it, but he's not been indicted, he's not been charged with carrying a gun. Issue has been raised, but the most significant thing about the charges that were used to seize his daughter were the fact that he was a member of the Oath Keeper group. Now, the purpose of Oath Keepers is simply to uphold the Constitution and to remind people in the military and the police force that, you know, their oath is to defend our Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And their oath is not to the government, their oath is to the Constitution, which is the very foundation of our system of law in Sydney. Many, many people have joined Oath Keepers, people in the military, people in retired military, law enforcement officials have joined the Oath Keepers, because that is where their allegiance is, not to President Obama, not to certainly Joe Biden, certainly not to Hillary Clinton. Their oath is to the Constitution, which they've sworn to uphold and protect from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we have so many domestic enemies of the Constitution and subversive groups here in this country intent upon destroying our sovereignty and merging us into a one-world government and destroying Christianity. But that's neither here nor there. Certainly, the fact that somebody was a member of Oath Keepers, but he really wasn't a member of Oath Keepers,
yeah.
But at least he was affiliated with them, he talked about it, and somehow or other they'd been spying on him, and they knew that he had talked about Oath Keepers and been engaged in some internet communication on this. Are they watching what everybody does? Do they have some sort of dossiers on citizens across America? And ladies and gentlemen, they do.
Indeed they do. In this case, what the affidavit said specifically was, quote, Mr. Ivers associated with a militia known as the Oath Keepers and has purchased several different types of weapons, including a rifle, handgun, and taser. Now, first of all, taking it in reverse order of seriousness here, a taser, we're told, is a non-lethal weapon. Every time a taser is used on somebody who displays so much as a tremor, a fleeting flicker of hesitation when given an order by somebody in a government-issued costume, we're reminded that the taser is a non-lethal weapon. Now, there was an incident in Houston in which a taser was taken from a police officer, and then the individual who had the taser, the quote-unquote civilian, was shot immediately by the police officer, and the shooting was justified as exigent defense against a lethal weapon. So apparently tasers only become lethal when they're in the profane hands of somebody who isn't wearing a state-issued costume. But in any case, a taser can be purchased legally. There are tasers that are advertised as gifts for women who are seeking to defend themselves against potential violence. I think that's a perfectly worthwhile use of that technology. Rifle, a handgun, and a taser. That's what's listed in the affidavit. That, coupled with his distant association with the Oath Keepers, was enough to create this image of the guy as an extremist with a short fuse, a potential menace to the community. He's what is known in the archaic laws of the former Soviet Union as a socially dangerous person. Now, that's a term of art that you found in the penal code of Soviet Russia that was a catch-all phrase used to describe somebody who was subject to summary arrest and even liquidation if it was seen to be necessary in the best interests of the Soviet state. And over the last 20 years, you could actually, I think, date this back to about 1988 when the cultural Marxist lobby in this country started to promote hate crimes laws. You started to see the creation of a foundation for prosecuting or at least treating people as socially dangerous persons, people who harbor opinions about matters of race or sex or nationality or religion that are seen to be retrograde and contrary to the best interests of the community. That's what the hate crimes enforcement measures are all about, and those have all, of course, gestated in that same kennel of collectivist watchdogs from which we see such specimens emerge as Morris Dees and the so-called Southern Poverty Law Center, which played a role, I believe, in this controversy, because the so-called Southern Poverty Law Center has been treating the Oath Keepers as a threat to the Republic by virtue of the fact that the Oath Keepers are willing to interpose on behalf of what remains of our tatterdemalion Republic. They're to be perceived as an enemy of the Republic because they take their constitutional oaths seriously and because they're not willing to carry out laws that are manifestly, patently unconstitutional and immoral. They're seen as a threat. This is a group which emphasizes nonviolent non-cooperation. In other words, these are people who would not shoot when they are ordered to do so in circumstances where there is no constitutional warrant or moral authority. And for that reason, they're seen as subversive, because they're not willing to become servile tools of the state. They're considered to be a menace. And by virtue of the fact that this guy had, once again, some peripheral association with the Oath Keepers, that coupled with the fact that he had firearms, made him a socially dangerous person. I mentioned earlier that I'd spoken with Stuart Rhodes. Stuart Rhodes I consider to be a brilliant man. I never had the pleasure of talking to him before this afternoon. And this is what he told me. Whether or not the charges against Mr. Irish are true, and parenthetically, he said that there are very serious charges in some of the other materials that had been sent to him with respect to this case. Mr. Irish had provided to Stuart Rhodes, who once again is a defense attorney, and he's setting up a legal defense fund for Cheyenne Irish and her father and mother. But what he said is that there are some very serious allegations that he thinks should be made public, because he doesn't think that the allegations, as serious as he described them to me to be, he doesn't think that they, taken in sum and substance, would be seen as justification for what was done here. He said, let us make all this stuff public. Give the enemies of this family no place to take this story, because his opinion is these don't meet the threshold of justification for what was done to this infant, this newborn infant, and her parents. But what he said is, whether or not the charges against Mr. Irish are true, this action is entirely unconstitutional and represents a very dangerous precedent. Using this man's political views and alleged affiliations to define parental suitability in any way is entirely illegitimate and a direct threat to the rights of parents who are political activists of any kind. In other words, if they can do this to this man who's considered to be, I guess you would call him a right-wing extremist, according to the current prevailing lexicon, what's to keep the powers that be from doing it, for instance, to peace activists in Chicago, or in Minneapolis, or in Detroit, or in North Carolina, or in California? The FBI, just over the last couple of weeks, has conducted armed raids on various homes and other meeting places that are occupied by people who are involved in self-described progressive or left-wing peace activism, people who oppose United States imperial foreign policy, which is a cause I wholeheartedly support, opposing that foreign policy, perhaps for different reasons, but the point is I would prefer that our government not be bombing people who have done nothing to harm us or threaten us in any way. To that extent, if no further, I agree with their sentiments. But you had this SWAT raid we talked about just 2 weeks ago, Dr. Stan, in Minnesota, in which the FBI literally kicked in a door because the woman behind the door wanted to see a warrant. They did so at a time when they endangered the life of her 7-year-old daughter. The warrant was basically an omnium gatherum. It was a catch-all. They were looking for anything they could find in terms of electronic storage media or paperwork regarding the travels and finances of the individual who lived at that home, who'd been involved in protests, raucous but peaceful protests back in 2008 during the Republican National Convention in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. They didn't charge him with a specific offense. They didn't cite their probable cause for treating him as a conspirator. But in spite of that fact, he was basically on the receiving end of the type of full-force raid that usually you'd see conducted in the context of a hostage situation. They literally sent a SWAT team with a battering ram to kick in this guy's door. Well, he had a 7-year-old daughter. What's to say that on the same principle that prevailed just a couple of days ago in New Hampshire, in Concord, New Hampshire, what's to say that they could not seize that 7-year-old daughter, citing this the political views of her parent as evidence of his unsuitability? He supposedly has been in league with Palestinian terrorists and leftist radicals and narcotics peddlers in Latin America. He denies that he has anything to do with them. There's no evidence that he has anything to do with them, apart from believing that the United States government is pursuing bad policies in the Middle East and Latin America. But what's to say, and given the fact that this man admits that he has firearms too, in spite of his political inclinations, he's a hunter, he has firearms. There, you have firearms coupled with radical political views. Why couldn't the government seize his 7-year-old daughter, summarily take her from the home because of the political views of that guy? That's the point that Stuart Rhodes is making. And unfortunately, what little attention has been paid to the case of Cheyenne Irish on the part of people who are not in the sort of right-wing populist libertarian paleo-conservative blockosphere, what little attention has been paid among self-described progressive civil liberties activists has been sort of the smirking, self-satisfied schadenfreude that you find on the part of people who regard their political opponents to be something less than human. There's actually a blog post I read from a progressive commentator today who said, well, this is the sort of a situation where a child should be taken from a home. Obviously, this guy is a nut. He's a lunatic. He subscribes to these bizarre right-wing conspiracy theories. That child's better off being someplace else. Well, the same thing could be said about these progressives that were on the receiving end of these FBI raids over the last couple of weeks. And this, once again, falls into the category we've talked about before of the man for all seasons principle, that wonderful speech that Thomas More in that play offers about giving the devil the protection of the law for our own safety's sake. People don't remember that. They don't understand that, as Thomas Paine said, to paraphrase, somebody who would protect his own liberties must protect the liberties of his enemies as well, lest a precedent be set that will undermine his own protection by the law.
Well, you know, we this last week interview, just I think yesterday, John and Therese, they run a ministry. It's called Daniel One. They sell health products, and but the government has targeted them because they've suggested that some of these products might help people who had cancer, and they actually won a case in the court. The case is going to be appealed to a higher level, and within a few days after they'd won this agreement from the court, why they sent in that 8 heavily armed people to raid their home, where because they have their vitamins and minerals, and seize everything there and smash in the door and wave their guns around. And you know, it almost appears to me that there's an...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount gold and silver trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a 1 ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
To get into Russia to actually create the counter-revolution, and this is what it was all about. Russia was chaotic. Russia had lost about 4 million men. There was no reason at all for Russia to be in the war. Almost every home had lost at least someone.
Yeah.
It was just a carnage. This is what the First World War was all about, to kill as many people as you possibly could, with the idea that at the end of the war, all nations would be willing to give up their sovereignty and, of course, bring about this League of Nations, the world government. But let's get back to what was going on in Russia, because Russia was chaotic, and here is Lenin there to actually foment a counter-revolution against Kerensky. Go ahead.
Yeah. Kerensky, of course, was somebody who took the revolution up to a certain point, and because he was not of a Bonapartist persuasion, he wasn't sufficiently ruthless to put down the Bolsheviks, but he ended up creating the nucleus of a system that, once taken over by the Bolsheviks, became much more ruthless than anything Kerensky could have imagined. Same thing happened in 1799 as the revolutionary government in France collapsed. They were looking for somebody who was willing to give the assembled roiling masses a whiff of grape shot, and none of the colonels was willing to do this except for the squalid little Corsican by the name of Bonaparte. He was willing to train the cannons on the people, and for that reason he emerged as the dictator. The same thing basically happened almost 118 years later, roughly, when Lenin ended up inheriting this quasi-socialist, quasi-revolutionary government, and then took advantage of the greatly enhanced powers that had been used to fight his movement, his insurrectionary movement, and turned it into an instrument of totalitarian rule, where every tremor of activity that was conceived, that was in any way conceivably oriented in opposition to the government, was treated as a form of terrorism. Little-known fun facts about history. The Cheka, the Soviet secret police that became known as the KGB eventually, which was organized, of course, by a bank robber named Felix Dzerzhinsky, the Cheka was originally created as a counterterrorism organization, terrorism being defined as any kind of organized opposition to Soviet rule. And out of that yeasty ferment of totalitarian arrogance, you got this notion of the socially dangerous person, which was inscribed into Soviet law, and it was the basic definition that was used in order to create a whole category of people who were summarily denied any kind of standing before the law. They literally outlawed people who were seen as political opponents of Bolshevik rule. I contend what's going on in New Hampshire right now, and what has happened in a couple of other instances I could cite, where people, because of their political opinions, have been treated as potential dangers to the community, I contend that this is an example of how the powers that be in this country have imported this concept of the socially dangerous person. You could go back, I'm opening up another window into this conversation, unfortunately, as it were, to use computer language. You could go back to the Jacobin Revolution in France, when there was something called the Law of Suspects that was passed that had the same effect. Basically, what that meant is that if you were accused of harboring sentiments that were contrary to the revolution, it didn't matter what overt act you undertook, or if there was an overt act, on the basis of what was imputed to you in terms of your opinions, in terms of your outlook on politics, you were to be considered somebody who was subject to summary imprisonment, or even worse, summary shortening by Dr. Guillotine's invention. Well, in the case of Jonathan Irish, you've got somebody who apparently has been accused of some serious misconduct as a parent. I don't know. I've not yet seen the paperwork on that. But when you take a look at the affidavit that was used to justify the seizure of his child, this was handed to him literally half a day after his child was born, his daughter was born. She was half a day old when he was lured, under false pretenses of having the child examined by a doctor, he was lured into a room where he was surrounded by police and social workers and presented with his affidavit that supposedly justified the kidnapping of his child under the color of supposed state authority, And the seventh specification on that document refers to this guy's political opinions. There's nothing else in that document that would seem to justify what happened on October 6th. There's mention, of course, of this firearms controversy involving potentially carrying a concealed weapon. There's mention of the fact that his fiancée has trouble with a couple of her children. But the only thing on that list that appears to justify, in the mind of some people, what was done is mention of his supposed political affiliations and opinions. That's Soviet-style intervention, denying the rights of somebody who's considered a socially dangerous person.
Well, these things seem to be happening with increased frequency across America today. And, of course, the thing is that when you do this sort of thing, nobody's ever punished. And we started with Randy Weaver, of course, where the government killed one of their own marshals and then wanted to use that as a justification to kill the entire family. And they would have if certainly Jack McLaren and Polk Wright hadn't intervened. But that's another story altogether. William, you go right ahead.
You mentioned the Randy Weaver episode here in Idaho. And, of course, the Randy Weaver atrocity happened just a few months before the even more repellent sequel at Mount Carmel, where you had about 80 people who were immolated on April 19th after a 51-day siege, in which the children, to paraphrase one of the local law enforcement officers at the Sheriff's Department, who stood by after being threatened with arrest by the feds who invaded that county, being threatened with arrest because he wanted to see justification for the treatment of the Branch Davidians. He described this as a process of torturing the children, trying to get the parents to surrender after the ATF conducted an illegal raid, a needless display of force. Four ATF agents were murdered. Forgive me, they were not murdered. They murdered two Branch Davidians. The Branch Davidians, in righteous retaliation, killed four of the assailants who conducted an armed assault on their home and their church. The four ATF agents should not have been killed. I mourn the loss of all of them, but the fact is they were the aggressors. The aggressors have no right to self-defense. And when they were shot and killed by the Branch Davidians were exercising a sovereign God-given right, unlike those who were attacking their home without legal cause or justification. But that created a 51-day standoff that culminated with the death of 80 people by fire and smoke inhalation.
Well, I have personal information on that, and some of those people were frankly killed. We do know, if you've ever seen that film, Waco, A New Revelation, that there were special forces there. They were sent out to kill them. I actually talked to I don't want to get off into another subject, but I have no question at all. They were intentionally murdered by government officials, but don't feel bad about it, about those special forces. They were sent off to a place called Somalia.
Yeah.
The Black Hawk down, the issue, and most of those people who participated in the murder of the Davidians died in that attack. Black Hawk Down, but most Americans don't know. Go right ahead.
Yeah. This, of course, was presided over by Jan Arino, who before becoming Attorney General had been a crusading prosecutor for the state of Florida in Dade County, and she giddily ripped apart families on the basis of completely transparently bogus child.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's William Grigg, and we've simply been talking about this unfortunate situation that occurred recently where a child was kidnapped in the nursery by government officials, taking away the child because, of course, in part, because the father of the child was a member of Oath Keepers. And those of you who know anything about Oath Keepers have heard my interviews with the man who created Oath Keepers. realize that this is not a subversive organization. In fact, these are people who love America. So we can only assume that there are people within government who don't love America, who don't believe in the Constitution, either that or they don't understand what Oath Keepers is about. But before we go on, William, I would like you to tell our listeners how they can listen to your radio program, how they can get to your blog, and how they can find your PayPal button and contribute to keep you doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. My blog and my radio program are both called Pro Libertate, and that's Latin. It's a phrase that means for freedom. Pro Libertate, the blog, can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or just Google Pro Libertate, PROLIBERTATE, and my last name, Grig, and you'll be able to find that very quickly. It should be the first response. If you type in my name or Pro Libertate, either one or in combination, the first return should be my blog. And I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week. As occasion warrants, I will update it more frequently. As my circumstances permit, I'll update it more frequently. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate. It's broadcast every Saturday night on the Liberty News Radio Network, libertynewsradio.com, from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time. That's 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock West Coast, or 9 o'clock to midnight Central Time. LibertyNewsRadio.com. If you go to the website, you'll find a number of things. For instance, the program can be listened to by way of internet streaming, or you can look for a list of terrestrial affiliates. I believe there are dozens now, or scores of terrestrial affiliates for Liberty News Radio. There's a listing there at the website. In addition, there are archives of all my programs and every edition of every other program that's offered to Liberty News Radio, which can also be received by way of podcast, by download from iTunes. And it also has a very active news page, which is frequently updated, libertynewsradio.com. Dr. Stan, you'd also mentioned that on my website, Pro Libertate, there is a PayPal button people can use to donate to the program, if you will. This is how I'm trying to support a family of 8 people, and God be praised, and also with thanks due gratitude to the generosity of many wonderful people, we've been able to get by for a number of months now on what people have been willing to share, willing to impart to us in order to keep this up and running. Pro Libertate is completely independent of necessity and also, quite frankly, by choice. I prefer to be disentangled from institutional connections that might compromise my independence. But that means, of course, that I'm like the proverbial street musician who's playing for tips. And so I really appreciate the generosity of everybody who sees fit to donate to Pro Libertate. It's been wonderful and a very humbling thing. I want to emphasize that the discussion we're having this evening is derived from an essay I published at Pro Libertate about an hour and a half ago entitled The Kidnapping of Cheyenne Irish. So if you go to Pro Libertate, that's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That's the very first essay you'll find. It's the top of the page. Please go there and read it. There are plenty of details in this outrageous incident that I won't be able to discuss in this program, and many other details that are forthcoming, and I promise that I'll be updating that story as I get more information as soon as I possibly can.
All right, well, let's go right ahead then with the story.
Well, I have been talking about the role that Janarino played in the Waco atrocity back in 1993, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because Janarino, before she was Attorney General, and she was Bill Clinton's third choice for Attorney General, who knows, maybe she was the first choice, the other two were simply put in as diversion, I don't know. But she had been a Dade County state prosecutor, which is to say a Florida state prosecutor assigned to Dade County, who, with robust abandon, destroyed families whimsically on the basis of palpably, penetrably fraudulent child abuse allegations. She had a track record that was perfectly mortifying. And in spite of the fact that she is childless for reasons that have never been made clear and unmarried, a bachelorette by choice, lifelong bachelorette, she considers herself to be, I guess, by virtue of her position in government, something of the grand supervisory mother of all the children within her area of jurisdiction. She brought that sensibility to her role as Attorney General. And during the first month of her tenure as Attorney General, she gave a lecture on the 9th of April to the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C., in which she talked about the idea of community policing. Now, remember that phrase, community policing. It was a term of art that entered the vocabulary in about 1993, and nobody really knew what it meant until people like Janet Reno fleshed it out. She saw community policing as a way of integrating social services and law enforcement for the purpose, basically, of creating a seamless web that families could not escape. You know, families that were removing themselves from the active scrutiny of government had to be brought back into the ambit of government control, and she saw community policing as a way of accomplishing this. Now, let me quote from what she said. They, meaning the families we're discussing, sit behind doors and they glare out at officialdom in whatever its form, a building inspector, a housing and urban development manager, a police officer, and they don't believe that person. They won't come out. They won't bring their child to the clinic because they are suspicious and unbelieving that government really cares. She's talking about a caring government on April 9th. At that very time, this 51-day siege was underway in which this same caring government was trying to starve and torture children at the Mount Carmel. They called it a compound. It wasn't a compound. It was a home. It was a church. As a way of exercising leverage on their parents. And they were pursuing, this is the other thing that I find really interesting, they were pursuing a psychological strategy that was mapped out in cooperation with a fellow by the name of Igor Smirnov from the Moscow Institute of Psychocorrection. In other words, they were turning to the masters of the Gulag for tips on how to go about creating a psychological torture campaign to turn these children into a weapon to use against their parents. That was the benevolent undertaking of this caring government that Janet Reno was talking about on April 9th, and of course 10 days later, they displayed their caring credentials by immolating or gunning down everybody who lived in that home, that sanctuary.
They blew them up, and basically they killed them, and basically they were negotiating and saying, well, now maybe we can work something out, and they'd already agreed to come out as soon as they, Koresh finished his final segment on the Seventh Seal, something of that sort. And while at the same time they were actually saying, you know, well, we'll get this worked out, and as soon as you get through the Seventh Seal, why, send the children out. They went in there, and there were special forces there, and if you don't believe it, we have a DVD where you'll actually hear several people from special forces talking about the special forces unit that went in and killed the people at Mount Carmel. If you've never seen that DVD, Waco, A New Revelation, you really need to see it, ladies and gentlemen. It'll break your heart.
Yeah, I agree with that. It'll break your heart, cause your gorge to rise, probably provoke you to grind your teeth into powder. And I believe the phrase that was used by one of the special forces personnel you mentioned was that there were people who were Delta Force operators who were pulling triggers on the morning and early afternoon of April 19th in order to ensure that the people who were trying to flee a building that had been set on fire through the actions of the federal government would not survive that afternoon. And the other part of that story that I find particularly grievous is that they prevented the fire trucks from getting there. They held them off. They would not allow emergency rescue personnel to get there and put out the fire, probably because they didn't want witnesses, is the way that I read the math. In any case, Janet Reno, who presided over that atrocity, was talking about a caring government using community policing in order to open doors that have been closed to the government. The Los Angeles Times provided a summary of that April 9th, 1993 speech, in which Reno urged the creation of what she called, quote, teams of community-friendly, highly respected police officers, social workers, public health nurses, and community organizers. And, of course, is how Mr. Obama described what he did for a living before becoming an elected official. These teams would pry open the doors of people who were burdened, handicapped, I guess, with a healthy distrust of government. Now, you saw community policing at work in New Hampshire, Concord Hospital, a couple of days ago, when you had a group of probably almost a dozen people who were gathered in a room for the purpose of tearing this newborn child away from her father and her mother because the father was considered to be politically unsuitable. That's how community policing operates. Now, earlier in this program, Dr. Stan, I made mention of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is run by this degenerate fraud named Morris Dees. It's a hugely profitable undertaking. It's in large measure a scam, but it also is deeply involved in indoctrinating law enforcement and social workers and educators, those clergy who are susceptible to their line of bull, regarding the so-called menace of anti-government extremism. Now, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as it happens, is also involved as an advisor to the Homeland Security Advisory Council, which last spring published a document regarding what they call best practices in preventing crimes that are supposedly inspired by political extremism. They talk about the need to prevent, quote, violent crime that is motivated by extreme ideological beliefs through threat mitigation and community policing. There's that expression, community policing. And Southern Poverty Law Center indoctrination, of course, is de rigueur for people who are involved in child protection services in New Hampshire and elsewhere, people who are involved in law enforcement in New Hampshire and elsewhere in the country. One of the other specifics mentioned in the Bill of Particulars against Jonathan Irish was that he was ordered by the court, for reasons that I've not yet been able to learn, to attend a seminar taught by a fellow named Dr. Scott Hampton, who's the director of an organization called Ending the Violence. Presumably that means that Jonathan Irish is involved in some kind of court-supervised program dealing with issues of anger or domestic violence. Supposedly, that might be the substance of these supposedly serious charges. In any case, this guy has not been sent to jail. He's not in police custody right now, although he's being treated as a political criminal. He's not been treated as a criminal in the sense that Americans would recognize that term. Now, Hampton, the guy who conducts this seminar, this guy was ordered by the court to attend, is evil. I won't cut it any finer than that. The reason I say he's evil, he might be avuncular, he might be personable, he might dress well, he might have a lovely singing voice, he might have the best of intentions, but he is a totalitarian. If you take a look at his literature, he's somebody who's devoted to the idea that prejudice, that is to say, opinions that he disagrees with, whether you're talking about things that are genuinely rooted in what decent people would call hatred or invidious impulses, or whether you're talking about political opinions that the left doesn't like, that the government has jurisdiction over the inner life of the individual, and that the government can use the leverage of state authority to compel the individual to change from within. Now, that's evil, because that is God's jurisdiction. That's something to which man does not have any appropriate access. There is something that works from the inside out to change a human being, to cure him of hatred and envy and pride. It's the Holy Spirit. As a Christian, I'm speaking now of the regeneration of the Holy Spirit. That's something God can do. It's a wonderful thing when it happens. That's not something government can do. The only way that government could exercise the supposed power to bring about this regeneration is by exercising authority over subjects that it does not have any proper jurisdiction and using the leverage of criminal aggression against an individual to do something that government simply can't do. It's a recipe for failure. And incidentally, this whole idea of the government being in charge of crafting the soul of the individual is exactly what happened in Mao's China. It's exactly what happened in Stalin's Russia. It is, in a word, totalitarian. Totalitarianism is evil. The people who promote it are evil. I'm afraid that Scott Hampton, in terms of what he's doing, is evil. I don't have access to his inner thoughts. I wouldn't presume to tell you the content of his heart. But in terms of what he is doing, he is pursuing objective evil. He's written a book, which is being used in seminars and conferences and to indoctrinate social workers, called Tolerant Oppression. And this is what he says in that book. Tolerance does not require that you give up your hatred. It just tells you how to act when you hate. That's not good enough. It's time that we teach people how not to hate. In other words, if you don't act on intolerant beliefs, for instance, among the supposedly intolerant beliefs he refers to is this non-affliction referred to by the ignorant coinage homophobia. If you don't believe that homosexuality or other forms of sexual deviance are healthy, if you even use the expression sexual deviance, that's a form of hatred. That's a form of intolerance. If you keep those opinions to yourself, that's not good enough. The government has the mandate, according to Hampton, to go into your soul and change your opinions forcibly. In this instance, they're using the leverage of kidnapping this man's child in order to force this guy into the mind laundry being run by this Dr. Scott Hampton. And that, once again, is a perfectly Soviet-style approach here, because they're talking about sending him essentially for psychological treatment involuntarily at the hands of somebody who will treat every opinion this man has as not merely wrong, as not merely a symptom of a psychological disorder, but as a form of objective evil that has to be forcibly beaten out of him through the instrumentality of state coercion. Now, there's one other aspect of the story. I don't want to spoil it necessarily, but there's a perfectly infuriating coda to this story that involves a similar case that occurred in Mississippi a couple of years ago when a woman who was an illegal immigrant from Mexico had her child taken from her, I think either on the birth, the day of the birth of the child or shortly thereafter. This was done improperly. There was no reason to take that woman's child. Irrespective of her immigration status, you don't seize a child from a mother. You know, particularly if you're going to be sending her back to Mexico, you don't take her child from her. But in order to do this, there were unsubstantiated allegations made that she was engaging in prostitution. This child was taken from her. For 18 months, they were separated. Eventually, a public interest law firm was able to reunite the mother and the child. There was no father in this picture, yet a mother and a child who were reunited after 18 months. I think that's appropriate because there's no reason to take that child from the mother. The public interest law firm behind this has filed a federal lawsuit against the hospital and against the officials who are responsible for this outrage. That, I think, is appropriate. Will they intervene to help Jonathan Irish and his family? No, they won't, because the public interest law firm that helped that parent and that child is the Southern Poverty Law Center, the same people who are distantly but substantially involved in this outrage in New Hampshire.
Well, we live in a very complex world, William, and it's tragic that and there's so many lives that are being ruined by government interference. The whole idea of our system of government was to limit the power of government so people could be free. And when the government takes upon it itself, you know, to keep all people from their folly, this is what we end up with. And is there any evidence that this woman would mistreat the child or that the father would mistreat the child? Certainly, if there is none. But, of course, they have the power, and they're going to misuse it. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts us, absolutely everyone. And we'll be back in just a moment with William Greig. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Dr. Stan, as always, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much for everything that you do.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. It is 8 October 2010, Friday, Feel Good Friday, that is, at the Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for caring about your world. And we have a special addition to the Power Hour today. In the studio, we have none other than the Josh Man. Josh Man.
It's just not Feel Good Friday without Josh.
No. That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. He just dropped in to the Power Hour today, so glad to have him. He was over in the neighborhood, so glad to have him joining us today. Thank you very much. You're celebrating something pretty special at your house today.
Oh, my baby said daddy.
Dad. Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
So tell us what it was like.
Oh, it just, you know, the whole heart-melting thing. She's been saying mama for a while. Both of the other children said dada first, and she's been saying mama, you know, crying for a while now, but she's saying dada now.
Aww.
It's so neat to watch her, you know, this little seven-month-old baby trying to say something. And it's like she's trying to get it out and has, you know, a hard time getting it. You know, you can just see the wheels working.
Oh, I can understand. I feel that all the time.
It's neat to watch.
Yeah, it really is. It is so special. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying every single day with her, and I know you all do. Your wife is still doing homeschooling, which is an amazing job.
Doing an amazing job, yes.
The children love it.
Yes, they do.
Very
good. We weren't sure how the kids were going to take it, but they seem to be really enjoying it.
Good, good. Well, if you're watching television today, you are seeing nothing but election, 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 and more election. Who cares? Does anybody really care? Does anybody feel like they have any control over the election? Or is it the machines that control the election? So if you're watching television, it is a giant, huge time waster. Yeah, go to big, heavy trucks, have accidents programs or things like that. You know, have you seen those on TV? Now, I mean, just kind of like with the ice road truckers. They have ice road truckers, then they have, you know, dirty jobs on TV. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can watch now other than the news if you have television. And it's all a giant time waster, really, when you think about it. But the election is the last thing you want to be watching right now because it makes no difference what they say. It's all going to change or it's all going to be cemented into place. But we're going to be talking about some stupid news today. Unfortunately, it's all over the place. I mean, I couldn't believe every story you listen to is as if you've got to be kidding me. That is a news story. People ought to be saying, who was responsible for that and how in the world did they let that happen? Also, sunscreen made with nanoparticles, guess what? It may actually cause cancer. Now, wouldn't it be something if they admitted, oh my goodness, we are so stupid, we caused the cancer that we thought we were keeping you from getting? The military is about to drug soldiers with a male bonding hormone. Yes. I don't think we'll be doing that at the Power Hour, will we? The Monsanto's super GMO corn failed. These are kind of the fun things that we like to talk about here on the Power Hour on Fridays, because it's Feel Good Friday when we give away our satellite dish system. McDonald's and 29 other firms get health care coverage waivers.
Yeah.
Somebody explain that one to me. Explain how a company who just said we are going to bring on another